this party didn't exist until the beginning of June. So it's an amazing story.
Japan's prime minister vows to reconnect with voters. It's Tuesday, July 4th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello. Join us, too, on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, a U.S. warship sails past disputed islands. As the United States turns 241, we look back at Chinese rail workers who helped shape this country. The U.S. Constitution withstands change, skipping injections, and some of the newest U.S. citizens, all on today's VOA Asia. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe acknowledged a severe judgment by voters in Tokyo, who on Sunday handed the ruling Liberal Democratic Party, or LDP, a stunning defeat in Metropolitan Assembly elections in Tokyo. The novice Tokyo Citizens First Party, of former Defense Minister Yuriko Koike and its allies, took 79 of the chamber's 127 seats to the LDP's 23 seats. Koike said, "We've seen many issues in national politics, such as scandals. It's up to the LDP to analyze and assess this result in the Tokyo Assembly election." Mr. Abe said voters thought his four-and-a-half-year-old national government was getting slack. He said the LDP must accept the result firmly and seriously and make every effort to return to its original aspirations. He said he wants to regain the people's trust and show results. Temple University Asian Studies professor Jeff Kingston tells VOA Tokyo voters hammered the LDP over what he called Mr. Abe's scandalous behavior.
He's been implicated in two separate cases involving favors doled out to cronies, allowing them to open schools on favorable terms. And so this cronyism cast a cloud over Abe, but I think voters are also very turned off by the way he ran roughshod over the Diet in ramming through his conspiracy legislation that a lot of people think was unnecessary and is going to deliver democracy in shackles. Koike and her brand new party won a convincing victory. They got the most seats in the assembly. This party didn't exist until the beginning of June, so it's an amazing story. It didn't help at all that the head of the LDP chapter in Tokyo, a close confidant of Abe, was implicated in a financial irregularities, and also his cabinet minister, defense ministry, she said that the self-defense forces and she backed a particular LDP candidate during the campaign, and this is unconstitutional. And so I think there's just so many different ways that the LDP found a way to lose this one big time.
Some political observers have noted Koike's campaign had similarities to Emmanuel Macron, who became the president of France in May.
Yes, I think that is a very apt comparison. I think that Koike is more of a known quantity. She's also, you know, a veteran lawmaker. She used to be a member of the LDP. So she's not quite Macron in that sense. But I think that the popular mood swinging against the establishment, against the corrupt and opaque ways, and Koike has tapped into that, and she promises a much more transparent government. Tokyo has 13 million people, and its budget is about equal to all of Sweden. So this is, you know, actually quite an important entity. And Abe has to be troubled. I mean, this is a referendum on his rule, and it doesn't look like the public has warmed up to him. And I think we're going to see from now on a diminished Abe, and I think that his one-time lock on becoming the LDP president again is now less certain.
Jeff Kingston said Mr. Abe does not have to call national elections until December 2018. And despite this setback, he said political opposition to the LDP is in disarray, polling in the single digits, and that presents formidable challenges for Koike to seek the country's top job. These are among some of the top headlines trending on VOAnews.com. The Philippines says top militant believed to be hiding in war-torn city. As Modi visits Israel, India embraces growing ties with Jewish state. New Thai labor rules sent migrant workers packing for home. To some, Chinese forays in disputed seas of Ring, a harmless national pride. And smokers' rights advocates resist tobacco regulation in Indonesia. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories. There's much more, too, on Facebook at VOA Asia. And while you're online, check out our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. China has protested another U.S. Freedom of Navigation mission in the South China Sea. The foreign ministry described as a serious political and military provocation the passage of the guided missile destroyer USS Stethem to within 12 nautical miles of Triton Island, part of the disputed Paracels that China has claimed as its own since 1974. That claim is contested by Vietnam and Taiwan. China said such missions violate its sovereignty and threaten its security. It was the second such operation since President Donald Trump assumed office in January. A similar freedom of navigation mission involved the destroyer USS Dewey near Mischief Reef in the Spratly Islands chain in May. University of New South Wales Professor Emeritus Carl Thayer tells VOA's Victor Beatty the Chinese view of the Paracels, closer to the mainland, differently than the Spratlys.
The Chinese drew straight baselines around the Paracels rather than baselines at low watermark. But sailing by Triton Island, which is the second time at least the U.S. has done that, that's an outlier. In other words, it's away from the larger grouping in the Paracels, and so China's claiming excessive space. So there's apparently two things the U.S. is challenging. One is the excessive claims of straight baselines and including an outlier in it. And secondly, China requires prior notification and approval, and the United States disputes that. There is freedom of navigation outside the 12 nautical mile territorial sea, and there's also the right of innocent passage, no military activities, and the Stethem wasn't reported to have done that. So in either case, the U.S. and its interpretation of international law would be different from China's.
Well, China called the operation, the voyage, if you will, serious political and military provocation.
They always do that, and they claim it's a serious threat to China. They monitor these. They send another ship to follow. They claim they put aircraft over the area. But these are, in a sense, okay, this may be the fifth or sixth freedom of navigation the United States under the current and past administrations have conducted. And none has led to any major confrontation.
Do you see any linkage between this particular mission by the USS Stethem and tensions between the U.S. and China over North Korea?
That's what's being speculated on, and it's plausible in the sense that the official statement that the U.S. Defense Department released says they don't acknowledge each freedom of navigation patrol as it occurs, but only in the annual report to Congress. But in this case, two U.S. naval officers were quoted to have told Fox News that broke the story that the Stethem had done so. So why is this signaling occurring? It follows the freedom of navigation patrol of the USS Dewey in the Spratlys. It follows arms sales to Taiwan. It follows the U.S. sanctioning individuals in a Chinese shipping company. And media reports in the U.S. of the Trump administration frustration with China's inability to apply more pressure on North Korea.
Carl Thayer said Chinese President Xi Jinping, facing a 19th Communist Party Congress later this year, will need to show he's cooperating with the United States on global and regional issues, thus strengthening the hand of President Trump in dealing with Beijing on both the South China Sea and North Korea. Happening now in Asia, at least 33 dead and hundreds of thousands evacuated from flooding in central and southern China during a more active rainy season than usual. China's Flood Control Authority says the water height in more than 60 rivers in southern China has risen above warning levels. Stay up to date with VOA 60 online every day. You're listening to VOA Asia. Glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Thanks for listening. This year marks the 150th anniversary of a Chinese railroad workers' strike in the United States as they were building the Central Pacific Railroad in the Sierra Nevada Mountains in California. Historians are still uncovering details of what led to that strike and what happened afterwards. VOA's Elizabeth Lee reports from San Diego, California, the home of a descendant of one of the railroad workers.
Of the Hong family. This is my grandmother.
A photograph is a window into the past. For Russell Lowe, these photos also represent his family's identity.
You know, my family took part in the building, not only of the West, but really building of America. That railroad that he helped to build really united our country, and it was probably one of the most important achievements for America in the 19th century, and we took part in that.
Lowe's great-grandfather, Huang Laihua, and his brother, Jikhua, like most of the Chinese railroad workers, came from China's Guangdong province and helped build the railroad that would link the western part of the United States to the east. Lowe believes his ancestors also took part in the labor strike of June 1867.
It's significant because this was the first major strike that any Chinese group ever did. Now, there were earlier strikes, but this was a major one, which involved 2,000 Chinese who struck for 1 week.
Chinese workers went on strike for more pay, shorter working hours, and better working conditions. While historians commonly believe the workers did not get what they wanted, historian Su Fan Cheng found new details in an old newspaper article.
But a month later, they got their at least their wage increase that they wanted from $35 to $40 a month. And it was sort of the Chinese system of, you know, save face. Okay, we'll let you save face by saying we didn't accomplish anything, but you'll give us the $5 increase a month.
After building the railroad, Lowe's great-grandfather stayed in the U.S., finding success in the cigar industry. He married Tom Ying.
She was brought here as a child slave. So we went from a railroad worker and a slave girl to the first Chinese graduating from UC Berkeley.
That was just one of their five children, the descendants of Huang number 100. They include war heroes such as Lowe's father, who received a Silver Star for his actions in the Second World War.
If you think about what binds these railroad worker descendants together, and we've all met each other, I think it's this courage of the ancestors. These young men who built that railroad had a right stuff, a determination where they never quit, knew how to adapt, they knew how to learn so they could bend like a supple willow tree and never break.
Those characteristics depicted here by Guangdong-born artist Mian Situ have been ingrained through the generations, honoring the legacy of thousands of Chinese who left their homes for the unknown in hopes of a better life in America. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, San Diego.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This news alert from VOA Asia, Singapore's prime minister addresses a rare special seating of parliament to defend the government's integrity, saying he wants to avoid suing his siblings for defamation over allegations he abused power in a dispute with them over his father's house. Check out VOA Asia Facebook for the latest stories and features to share. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. Each year, the National Archives organizes events marking the 4th of July. That's the birthday of the United States of America. This year, the National Archives prepared an especially fitting exhibition entitled Amending America. It's a story about thousands of failed attempts to change the U.S. Constitution, a succinct body of fundamental principles and precedents by which America is governed. VOA's Nicoletta Illich recently caught up with National Archives curator Christine Blackerby.
The United States Constitution embodies a simple, far-reaching concept, recognizing that people's rights are granted directly by the Creator, not by the state, and people only then grant rights to the government. Nothing like it had been done before. America's founders believed that a government made up of imperfect people exercising power over other imperfect people should possess limited powers. The Constitution delegates to government only those rights the people wanted to have. Through the years, the 8-page-long U.S. Constitution has been exposed to numerous proposals to amend it, says National Archives curator Christine Blackerby.
There have been over 11,000 proposals in Congress for constitutional amendments. So an amendment is proposed when a member of Congress introduces it into either the House or the Senate.
Attempts to change the Constitution began almost from the moment it came into force in 1789. The Bill of Rights, 10 amendments listing 10 specific prohibitions on government power, was adopted in 1791.
There's been three main reasons, or kind of big ideas, that have resulted in constitutional amendments. The first one is rights. So there have been many amendments, the most, in fact, 17 of our 27 ratified amendments have expanded rights, including voting rights, but also the right to free speech or free exercise of religion and many other rights.
Another continuing theme, says Blackerby, is regulating the power of government.
So, for example, we have limited the president of the United States to serve 2 terms.
There were other proposals such as choosing president by lottery or abolishing the Electoral College, as well as regulate marriage, migratory birds, and drinking alcohol. There were also periods of intense amending activity, mostly during times of social change. The biggest number of proposed amendments is related to the Equal Rights Amendment adopted by Congress, but not by all U.S. states. None of the subsequent 1,100 proposals to incorporate it into the Constitution worked, says Blackerby.
That 3/4 of the states have to ratify it. So although the Equal Rights Amendment passed Congress by a 2/3 vote, it failed to be ratified by the states and is not part of the Constitution.
History has proven that it is hard to make a constitutional change, which Blackerby says is a good thing. Early generations of Americans pledged their lives to the cause of individual freedom and limited government, warning that vigilance would be required to preserve freedom for posterity.
VOA's Nicoletta Illich. Developing at this hour in Asia, Indonesian officials say a helicopter carrying 8 passengers and crew crashed on its way to help evacuate people from an active volcano, killing all 4 crew members and 4 Indonesian Navy officers on board. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, scientists have developed a skin patch that VOA's Jessica Berman reports may soon take the ouch out of getting vaccinated.
Every year in the United States, less than half the population gets a flu shot, according to experts who've developed a skin patch they hope will improve that statistic. Professor of Infectious Diseases Nadine Rufael of Emory University School of Medicine in Georgia was a principal investigator of the trial to judge its effectiveness.
The patch looks more like a Band-Aid, like a nicotine patch, and then it has multiple very small needle that contains, in this case, the influenza vaccine. Those microneedles will completely dissolve into the skin, and there will be no sharp waste afterwards.
The flu vaccine is administered by an injection into the muscle of the upper arm. It's painful and can leave some redness and swelling, which is why an estimated 60% of all people do not get immunized against seasonal flu. The vaccine patch, which is worn for just a few minutes and then discarded, contains tiny dissolvable microneedles that administer the serum. The trial involving 100 participants aged 18 to 49 took place in June 2015. None of the participants had received a flu vaccine during the previous influenza season. The participants were divided into four groups, with the patch being administered by either a healthcare provider or by each participant. Some of the participants also received the vaccine via injection, and a fourth group got a placebo. Rufael says the patch, whether it was put on the skin by a healthcare provider or by the participants, was as safe and effective as the intramuscular injection. Side effects were limited to mild redness and swelling, which lasted for a few days. Writing in The Lancet, the investigators report that 6 months later, the immune responses were still present in both the patch group and those who received the injection, meaning both methods offered comparable protection. And Rufael says the participants who used the patch liked it.
We do have a lot of people that are typically scared of needles, and they're more prone or were more excited about being part of this clinical trial so they could try the microneedle instead.
Rufael says 70% of those who received the patch said they would prefer it to receiving an injection. Because it does not need refrigeration, Rufael says the patch could be bought off a store shelf or mailed to patients. The fact that it's painless, says Rufael, means more people are likely to get vaccinated against the seasonal flu virus. The patch's manufacturer, Global Center for Medical Innovation in Atlanta, is investigating using the device for other vaccines, including for measles, mumps, and rubella. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
One of the themes of this year's Smithsonian Folklife Festival is immigration. It's happening just outside of our studios, and VOA's Elizabeth Chernoff went out the door and found a group of 25 children who were sworn in as U.S. citizens as part of the festival events just ahead of our Independence Day holiday.
Washington's heat and humidity was no deterrent for a group of immigrant families watching as their children received their certificates of U.S. citizenship.
I'm really excited and I feel so happy.
12-year-old Sada from Colombia is one of 25 children honored at the ceremony. Her mother, Anna Maria, looked on proudly from the front row.
We are so happy for this opportunity. It was so special because it's a different place. Ceremony meant only for kids, and it's an special day for us.
Organizers say the 50th anniversary of the Smithsonian's annual Folklife Festival presented a unique opportunity to celebrate the next generation of Americans. Kim Zanotti, who administered the oath, says ceremonies like this one represent important chapters in each child's American story.
Now they have all the privileges that an American-born citizen, like myself, may take for granted. They can vote, they can totally participate in our democratic republic, they can hold political office, they can serve on a jury, they can get a United States passport, making it easy for them to travel back to their country or to any other country around the world. So it really is the start of their American journey.
A journey beginning just days before Independence Day, marking America's 241st birthday. Elizabeth Chernoff, VOA News, Washington.
And it is the 4th of July, also known as Independence Day. It's been a federal holiday here in the United States since 1941. But the tradition of Independence Day celebrations goes all the way back to the 18th century and the American Revolution. On July 2nd, 1776, the Continental Congress voted in favor of independence. And then 2 days later, delegates from the 13 colonies adopted the Declaration of Independence. Some constitutional scholars argue Americans should mark July 4th on July 2nd because of that historic vote. Also historic are the annual fireworks displays. Congress authorized the use of pyrotechnics as part of Independence Day celebrations in 1777. And of course, they've been a mainstay of July 4th celebrations ever since. No matter where you are in the world, we always celebrate the 4th of July. We love everybody else to celebrate it with us, so feel free to do so. You've been listening to VOA Asia. You can get our program many different ways. iTunes and SoundCloud are good places to go. Also, our website at voanews.com. We'd like to send a special hello to everybody listening on the voice of Chung Rung, Star Radio FM 88.3 at Chung Rung Christian University in Tainan, Taiwan. We also thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, Daryl Smith. Managing Editor Diane Gao, Ali Ogden and David Byrd on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.